Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to musician Glenn Burtnick, who you may know from his solo career, from playing Paul McCartney in the original West Coast version of Beatlemania, to his work with the Stone Pony house band, Cats on a Smooth Surface, or as the guy who stepped into Tommy Shaw's shoes with Styx. As for me, I'll always know Glenn as the older kid next door when we were growing up in apartments on Phillips Road in Somerset, New Jersey. Stick around. You never know what could come next. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience that includes Southside Johnny, John Eddy, Phil Garland, and a bunch of other guys briefly pronounced as the next big thing from New Jersey in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. There aren't many people, besides my mom, who I could introduce by saying I've known them all my life. But that's true of Glenn Burtnick. But don't get me wrong. I'm not at all suggesting we know each other well or have ever even hung out. It's just that in the early 1960s, our families were neighbors in a low-rent apartment complex in Somerset, New Jersey. Our moms were friends and remained so for many years to come, even as both families separately relocated to more suburban digs in North Brunswick. Now, Glenn was the first person to ever attempt to teach me how to play the guitar. The first of many to fail at that task, I might add, but the only one who went on to play Paul McCartney in Beatlemania. Now, he also married Rosemary, beautiful girl down the street, so I saw him in passing from time to time. Now, the only time I believe we were ever in the same room together in the last 40-plus years was probably around 1984, I think, could be wrong, when my wife and I went to the Stone Pony in Asbury Park on a Sunday night to wait with the faithful to see if Bruce Springsteen would show up and play a set with the club's house band, Cats on a Smooth Surface. Their guitarist, Glenn Burtnick. Now, I'm waiting for Glenn to see if he corrects me and say that the timing is off.
You're doing great.
Okay.
Wow.
All right. Music has been very good to Glenn over the years. During his Beatlemania run, he built a lasting friendship with the performer cast as John Lennon, a guy you also may have heard of, Marshall Crenshaw. And during that same period of time, he was hired by Jan Hammer to be the singer in his band, Hammer. And that's how he met his friend and future Santana and Journey player, Neil Schon. Now, a little bit of an aside. During his time with Cats on a Smooth Surface, he became friendly with a guy named John Bon Jovi, who invited him to join his new band. Glenn declined. Bon Jovi went on without him. Don't know whatever happened to him, though. Glenn recorded two solo albums for A&M Records, Heroes and Zeros and Talking in Code. When going out on his own didn't work out as he hoped, he received a phone message one day from Dennis DeYoung asking if he would consider auditioning for his band, Styx. Tommy Shaw had moved on to tour with Damn Yankees, and the band needed a second guitarist and another songwriter. Now, if you didn't know Glenn before, you've certainly got several good reasons to get to know my old neighbor now. And by the way, you can see Glenn live in concert with the orchestra. That's featuring former members of the Electric Light Orchestra and ELO 2 at Ruth Eckert Hall in Clearwater, Florida, on Friday, January 31st. I don't know the time. Get tickets online at RuthEckertHall.com. And no, I just checked, Glenn was neither a member of ELO or ELO 2. We'll talk about that. Glenn Burtnick, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Good to see you. So, Glenn, what's new since 65? Get me caught up.
Since 1965, we landed on the moon.
Uh-huh.
I graduated high school, and I stubbornly refused to give up my dream of making music and making a living at music. And, you know, the older I get, the more I question that decision. But I am very fortunate. You know, I'm 58 now, so I basically consider myself 60 because you had $58 in your pocket and somebody asked you, you know, how much you got on you, you'd say 60. Right? So, but anyway, I'm almost 60 years old, and I have made a living in a odd career, and I've done a lot of things. I've written hit songs, and I've played in a number of different types of acts, and I've worn as many hats as I could, and you know, it's been a really good run, and I'm kind of cracking up at the fact that I'm still doing what I wanted to do and started doing at, you know, 16 years old or something. You know, I'm basically getting up on stage and, you know, playing make-believe rock star, and an audience, you know, loves me for it, and they clap, and I'm like, yeah, so I get a lot of, you know, gratification out of that career choice.
What was it as a teenager that turned you on to not just music, because, you know, everybody loves music as a teen, but made you want to be the guy on stage playing the music instead of just, you know, one of us guys out in the audience clapping and cheering?
Well, you know, like I said, I was a little stubborn. I'm told by my family that when I was, before I was talking, I would react to music. You know, like if a beautiful song would come on the radio or something, I would start crying and stuff. Like, music has always had like a super emotional effect on me. So there was that. I mean, I was always drawn to music. And then when I was around 8 or 9, the Beatles came on Ed Sullivan, and so then I got caught, and that was huge, a huge cultural moment, and I got, you know, wrapped up in the music of the 60s. After the Beatles came, you know, Bob Dylan and Jimi Hendrix and all this wonderful music. The 60s were really an explosion of pop culture, and those were formative years for me, and so I think the combination of being very attuned to music, getting, you know, feeling emotionally drawn to it, and living through this decade of incredible inspirational pop music, which, by the way, continues, won't let go. You know, I mean, I do a lot of Beatles shows. I appear at Beatle conventions and stuff like that, and there's no shortage of young people that are still drawn to the music. So, in fact, I hang out with a lot of younger musicians, and they all are emulating music from my youth, and it cracks me up. It's like, you know, young guys trying to emulate the band or some past, you know, some groups from the 60s. But anyway, so I think the combination of all of those elements just kind of sucked me in, and I just followed. I followed my dream.
Do you remember the first person who said, yeah, you could do that? Maybe heard you singing and go, yeah, you should go on stage or enter a contest, or you have a good voice. You can play.
I don't. I mean, slowly, I wasn't very good, I don't think. I thought I was good. I've always thought I was good, but I didn't really hear a lot of encouragement, but although my family wasn't discouraging. You know, my mom got a drum set for me, and a guitar found its way home. One of my brothers brought a guitar home, and I just stubbornly thought that everything I came up with, everything I wrote, I thought was just brilliant, you know, and I'm sure it wasn't. I mean, I can't remember those early songs, but it was just this, you know, I was tuned to the same channel. You know, it's like I'm going to make it. I'm brilliant. I'm the next Bob Dylan, whatever, you know. And so I just kind of stuck with it. I'm sure at some point, you know, when I was in high school, I had a music teacher that took, you And I think it's also, it's not, because of that stubborn streak that I'm talking about, I think what that is ambition. And when you meet somebody that has a lot of drive, and you realize that they're very serious about drive, and very just motivated, you take notes and you say, wow, this person's working very hard, and I'll bet you they go someplace. So, I don't know. I mean, and my songwriting got better as I kept doing it and doing it and doing it. I've written a lot of songs in my life. So, and then when you get the big record deal, or when I passed the audition for Beatlemania, when you go, auditioning is a scary thing. When you, I went up and I auditioned, and then they said, you got the gig. That's gratifying and a pat on the back. So I seem to always get enough support to make me convinced that I was right.
Well, the story that I've seen is with the Beatlemania, because you basically make this leap from being this high school kid who wants to play music and believes in his own head that he can do this and is good at it, and then the next big thing seems to be the Beatlemania. You saw an ad in the Village Voice and for auditions. Did you know what you were even auditioning for at the time? Would they actually have gone that far and said?
Yeah, the show had been in production a year already. Yeah. And so I was aware of the show. But interestingly, I did not approve of the show. I thought it was I thought it was kind of a cheap imitation kind of thing. But as a young musician looking for breaks and stuff like that, I auditioned because I figured, well, maybe there's money here, maybe I'll get paid. And when I passed the audition, I still had this feeling of like, I'm not sure I want to do this or not. And the musical director asked me, well, have you ever seen the show? And I said, no. And he said, come on with me. Like that night, I think, or maybe a few nights later, I went to see Beatlemania, and it completely got me. I was like, wow, I want to be a Beatle. I've always wanted to be a Beatle. And there it was, four guys on stage and just in a beautiful theater playing these songs that I grew up with. It's like, how could I say no? I was a young man. And what's funny is it was less than 10 years after the Beatles had broken up and less than 20 years since they had exploded. So it was really very, just judging by the way I look at life now, it was soon after the Beatles had actually, become the cultural icons that they did. But I went along with it because I thought, well, that looks like a fine, gig. And I enjoyed it. I did enjoy it. I got out of it kind of quick. I did it for a year. Then I got sick of it because it was very, it was a lot like a play. They didn't want you to vary much from a script and, so that's kind of uninspired, or it wasn't used to what I was used to, which is like rock and roll. I was like a rock and roll guy. And so I didn't, so I felt compromised and controlled. So after about a year, I left, and that's when I saw another ad in the Village Voice for Jan Hammer, who I was a fan of. So I answered that ad too.
Well, let's hold off on Jan for a second. You play a year of shows. This was out on the West Coast. First of all, had you even been on the West Coast before?
No, that was my trip to the West Coast. It was my first time in L.A. They flew me out, and it was wonderful. But also, I might add that I have a distinct memory that those were the days. It was 1978, and those were the days that air flight was still kind of glamorous, and and so I sat on a plane with a big plane, like a jumbo jet, and there was hardly anybody around. I mean, I was like, it was like an open plane. It's all me. And you know, now, as you probably know, you get on an airplane and there's every seat is sold. And in fact, they oversell.
Right.
I spent a lot of time on airplanes now. But back then, I felt like I had my own flight attendant, my personal flight. So anyway, yes, I went to Los Angeles for the first time and then did the show there for about 6 months and then did the show in San Francisco for about 4 months and then did the show in San Diego for about 2 months. And then then we were done with that run and I quit. You know, I said, well, see you guys. And that's when I started to do it.
So you went from having not been out to the West Coast, having not been on stage per se day after day. It sounds like it was an incredible experience for the future of your career because you probably, I'm just going to guess here, you just stop me if I get it wrong, but you learned how to travel, you learned how to be out on the road, you learned how to give a consistent performance day after day, I'm guessing, and it probably moved your career dramatically forward in ways that you could no one could have predicted to you a year earlier.
I think so. I learned a lot. Like, as you pointed out, I also learned, you know, it was a very dedicated show. Instead of just doing arrangements of Beatles songs, it was, you know, about being a stickler for playing the bass parts on the record and singing the same phrasing that were on the records. And, you know, it was very, very attuned to trying to recreate as close to perfect these records. So it was a learning experience musically for me and professionally about touring and traveling. And also, you know, I've always said I didn't go to college. I went to Beatlemania. The guys that I worked with, because there were two casts for every show. And all those guys from Beatlemania, they're kind of like my army buddies, you know, or, you know, college fraternity, you know, in a way, because we keep in touch. We occasionally get together for, you know, weddings and stuff. And, so it was, it was an important part of my life, for sure.
And did you and Marshall Crenshaw start at the same time?
Pretty much, yeah.
And did you? I mean, you must look back now and go, yeah. I mean, we both were talented guys, and we both have had careers. Anyone else from that cast break out in the same way that you guys eventually did?
Well, Marshall would be the most successful. There was a guy named David Leon. He was a John Lennon character, as was Marshall. And David got a record deal with a band called Helmet Boy, and he called me to ask me to come out and join the band. So I joined that band, and we made a record on Electro Asylum Records. So, you know, there were... Rob Lauffer was George Harrison as well. There were a couple of guys, but for the most part, just a few of us actually kind of moved on to another career point, you know, like a job.
Well, so I'm asking a little bit more about the Beatlemania thing right now, just because of the timing. About 2 weeks from when you and I are talking, maybe 3 weeks... Math was never my thing. It's the 50th anniversary of the first Beatles concert in the U.S. So, you know, I think we're going to find that people are a little more tuned into Beatles stuff. Do you recall, were people upset about the play out on the West Coast? Was it ruffling feathers? Did you ever get any sense, or on the opposite end of that, did you ever get any sense that anyone from the Beatles had come in to see the play?
Reportedly, none of the Beatles did. One guy from the cast from the original cast, Mitch Weissman, who was a Paul McCartney lookalike. He encountered John Lennon on the streets back then, and they spoke a little bit. He said that Lennon was very kind, and Lennon said, "Yeah, my son Julian saw the show, and he said it's really great."
Wow, cool.
So, but yeah, now none of the Beatles have seen that show, and I don't know that they're interested. But there's so much now. In retrospect, it just dawned on me also that I'm left-handed and I play the bass the left-handed, and that probably helped get me gig because there were a lot of McCartney was left-handed, and there were a lot of some of the other Pauls in the show were right-handed, but I kind of came in with that distinction.
Cool. All right. So you mentioned Jan Hammer a little while ago, and I deferred that to now. What was the timing on working with Hammer? Was that before or after Miami Vice? I'm not really clear on that.
Oh, yeah, before. Jan Hammer was the synthesizer player, the keyboard player for Mahavishnu Orchestra, mm-hmm. and then he got involved with Jeff Beck. He wrote, produced, and played on a number of Jeff Beck records, and so that was all right up my alley. I was very intrigued by Jan, and he's a brilliant musician. And so I answered that ad. I sent him a bunch of songs, and they were interested, you know. And so I got that gig.
Classified advertising been very important to Glenn Burtnick. There's a whole generation out there that may not get their opportunities because classified ads are going away. What do we do about that? I don't know. So I guess I'm going to jump around a little bit. But as I kind of gave the sense of people in the introduction, there's a lot of Glenn Burtnick history because you've played with a lot of people, you've done a lot of things. I'm kind of curious when you. You're largely associated with the Jersey Shore now. I think you, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you're actually living in that area, right?
Yeah, I'm so living in Asbury Park, yeah.
Oh, you actually are in Asbury? Yeah. Okay. Was it hard for people, let's say in the 80s particularly, who were musicians, to come out of that area because of the big shadow cast by Springsteen?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it actually helped, you know, Bruce's success was so large that it was, you know, it was a story to talk about if you're doing an interview or whatever, you know, in your bio or something to say that, you know. I mean, I've played with Bruce Springsteen a number of times because he loves to play, and I'll get up at a bar and play with him. Mm-hmm. And, so you kind of feel like, you know, you're in the presence of greatness, and you feel like maybe you're in a fraternity of, Asbury Park musicians. And that. So I don't think it was hard. What I didn't want to do was talk about Beatlemania when I did interviews for my solo careers or any of my stuff. I kind of kept that quiet because I just thought, you know, I don't know. It's not the most... there was an imitation factor to being in Beatlemania at the time. I just thought I was a little embarrassed about it, so I didn't talk about it.
Well, I was curious. You know, I remember my visits up to New Jersey over the years have become, you know, more and more stretched apart. But there was one time in the 80s that I came up and there was a club. You'll probably remember the name of it. It was on Route 1, close to 130, where the Boy Scouts used to be. It was a big club, and they used to book national acts in there.
Yeah. The Royal Manor for a while.
Yeah, that sounds familiar, something like that. And it just happened that the week that I was there, they had Clarence Clemons and the Red Bank Rockers, and opening for them was John Eddy. And I had heard about Eddy, but he hadn't recorded, I don't think, at that point. And he was one of these guys who, and there have been a number of them over the years, I kind of make reference to that kiddingly in the introduction, a lot of guys who have been the next Springsteen or the next, you know. And So I thought a lot of pressure on Eddie, I think, to be that guy. And then he had to go – it seems to me, and maybe I got this wrong, it seems to me that he kind of had to disappear for a while, and he remade himself over the years as more of a country guy and seems to have found his comfort level there.
Yeah, he's actually doing really good. He's written a song or two that was cut by – oh, my gosh. I can't remember right now, but he's the guy that used to go out with Sheryl Crow. Anyway, and wears a hat. Anyway, so he's actually had a couple of big records that he's written for others, and he's doing good.
That's good.
Yeah, but he definitely very inspired by Bruce.
Right.
He owes a lot to Bruce. He's a friend of mine and hardworking guy.
Yeah, I've got just happened over the years upon some singles of his. The one I really like was I want to say it's called 40, where he sings about being 40 and Bruce Springsteen's 53 or the Stones are nearly dead. And I saw that, and then I started tracking down some more stuff. And anyway, I've been trying to get him to come on for a while. Maybe he'll see you and he'll go, oh yeah, well okay.
Next time I see him, I'll put in a good word.
That would be nice. So let's come back to the pony for a minute. So I mentioned that my wife and I had come up there. I basically had come up there at the time to do a story for the St. Petersburg Times about this whole phenomenon of Sunday nights and, you know, is Bruce going to show up? And the rumors are always going around. And I assume that the rumors were fed by whoever owned or managed the pony So I'm hoping that you can, for people who never had that experience of being up there when Cats were playing and Bruce would show up and play, maybe you can give us a little sense of that. For example, did you actually know ahead of time if he or somebody else was going to show up, or was it really that random?
Sometimes we would know, but usually he would just hang. You know? He would kind of come out. I'll say this, that often I would know he was in the club or the bar because because the audience would suddenly change, and a lot of, like, the audience would come to the front of the stage and just stand there, and you thought, like, okay, why? And they just kind of stare at you, and then you realize they're not really watching us; they're waiting for something,
mm-hmm.
You know, and so you just. So a lot of times you would just know. One of my favorite stories is that he was in the bar. He didn't do anything. He didn't get up. And we finished our set, and it was like encore time or something. And I walked out the stage door, and the audience is clapping to bring us back on. And there's Bruce walking on the sidewalk. And I said, hey, Bruce, you want to play? He's like, ah, I don't know. I said, come on. And he said, ah, all right. It was kind of me asking, getting Bruce to get up, which was kind of nice.
Cool. And what kind of stuff on those nights? What would you play? And were you always prepared for what? Was he prepared for what you were going to play, or were you would have to be prepared, I suspect, for what he wanted to play?
He's pretty notorious for getting up when he gets up at a jam or something. He's going to do like Mustang Sally and Twisted Shout and kind of these very simple R&B, chestnut, early rock and roll kind of thing. It keeps it simple, which makes sense, because then there won't be any train wrecks on stage. he likes to do the those Workhorses songs.
Raise Your Hand, I'm sure. Would it be fun for you guys, or would it be disruptive? Would you, were there nights where you'd come in and you just want to get through your gig, go home, or, was that something that, was always special?
Always special. Mm-hmm. You're definitely in the presence of greatness, and you're collaborating to a certain extent with a superstar, an iconic musician.
And I understand Cats on a Smooth Surface was not a bad band at itself. Who else was in the band over the years that you played with?
Well, Bobby Bandiera was the other guitarist. And he went on to, he plays with Bon Jovi.
Yeah.
Like the second guitar player in Bon Jovi for years. Fran Smith was the bass player, and he went on to be in the Hooters. Remember the Hooters?
I do.
Yeah. And so there's... Oh, and Ray Anderson, the keyboard player, he did a tour with Meatloaf. And that's kind of all I remember, but that's not bad. That's not bad.
It's funny about the Hooters. My sister actually... My sister went to school at Glassboro eventually, and she actually was the one who turned me on to... the Hooters, and sent me an album at the time. It was probably an 8-track, knowing me. She probably sent me an 8-track. And I thought, these guys were great. And it was only about a week ago that I heard one of their songs on the radio. They had a very distinctive sound. And I said to my daughter, who's now 17, I said, that was a great band. I don't know whatever happened to them, but they had this very unique sound, and it just didn't seem like they went beyond an album or two.
Yeah, well, they stopped having hits, but they keep making records, and they have a successful career in Europe. They tour, they go over to Germany like at least once a year, and which is not unusual. European audiences are a little less trendy. They love that you know, they'll stick with an artist beyond their hit makers. So. Yeah, so they still play.
I'm glad to hear that, actually. It's nice to hear. Maybe some chance they'll wind up down here touring or something. Speaking of Europe, as someone who's been following you on Facebook for a while, you seem to be doing pretty well with that that racket as well, getting over there frequently.
Yeah, the orchestra in particular, the ELO band, does a lot of touring in Europe, Eastern Europe, Russia, South America, and we've been up to Alaska as well. Like a lot of traveling, you know, which is awesome. You know, I was like standing in Red Square a couple of months ago. You know, just like amazing, amazing travel and beautiful Italy, Spain. You know, just seeing the world. Which also cracks me up that at this age I'm still touring and playing all these exotic places, and you know, getting paid.
Well, and does it? I mean, I don't take this the wrong way, because I don't mean it badly. I have a feeling it's going to come out the wrong way. But does it bother you at all that, as you look back? I mean, as you know, as I'm getting ready to talk to you today, if you know, for a real interview, I'm looking at okay. He did the year with Beatlemania playing Beatles songs. He, more recently, you know, you stepped in for Styx twice, have toured and written songs and recorded with Styx. Now the orchestra, which is made up of ELO members. It seems like that has been a very good source of work and income for you. Probably not where you would like to be, I'm guessing, in terms of being able to record and get out there on your own music more often.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I do record occasionally now, and I'll put a song on iTunes or something, but it's not really so cost-effective anymore. I don't have that many fans. I do, you know, a lot of people might know my name, maybe, but my original music isn't, you know, yielding what it once did. I was a very successful songwriter throughout the 90s. And but then I rejoined Styx, and that's when I was taken out on the road for about 10 years, because Styx plays all the time. They're a very, very busy band. And so they, you know, so I guess, you know, and when I got off the road from Styx, I was out of the loop, the songwriting loop, and there was a whole new generation of hip-hop and stuff, music that was taking over the pop charts, and what I did wasn't necessarily in vogue. So, yeah, maybe, yes. But I'll tell you, the life of a original solo artist or whatever, or an original band, is hard. Unless you make a big, big splash. It's you're not traveling easy, and it's pretty hard travel. Whereas if with a band like Styx or a band like the Orchestra, we're well compensated to play music that I had no part of. Or, well, with Styx, I did write a lot. But in any case, but their biggest records I wasn't on. So, and like I said, as I get older, I don't feel like I need the ego gratification so much. It's a career, it's a business job, and I'm very pleased to get paid to do what's really fun.
Absolutely. I think it's awesome that, you know, let's say 40 years since you've started professionally. I don't know how old you were when you started with Beatlemania, but I mean, that's a long time to be making a pretty good living as a musician. You've played your own music at times. You're playing other people's music, but you're still playing. You're up on stage. You're seeing in front of, you know, thousands of people, and I think it's amazing. It's great.
Yeah, it's a blessing. You know, I just feel really fortunate, and I don't take it lightly. I enjoy it, you know, and I appreciate the breaks, because I do have a number of friends that I've played with throughout the years that just never got the kind of breaks that I've had, and you know, so I recognize how fortunate I am.
And just last question about Styx. Are they still touring? Are you still part of that? If they do go out, how does that stand?
No, I left that band. What was happening was that my marriage was falling apart, partially because I was away all the time. Mm. And so I said, you know, in order to save my marriage, I got to leave the band, which I did, but it didn't work. So I got divorced, and you know, but they are definitely still touring. They're a very busy band. They kind of live on the bus, you know. Hmm. Which, you know, that's, they're well taken care of, but it is, that's a little hard too. Sleeping on a bus and driving and driving and driving. Hmm. So it's not all fun and games.
To be honest, Glenn, I got to tell you, I'm just as glad that you're not still part of the band with Styx, because I didn't want to get caught in a conversation of being asked or having to think up a Styx song that I liked, because there really were none. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I remember covering them as a music critic for the St. Pete Times back in the 80s, and it's the kind of thing where it's like I had to go there, and I was there, and I tried to evaluate based on what I saw. I didn't try to give away that I just wasn't a Styx fan, but it just wasn't my thing. Now, ELO, on the other hand, I want to ask you about ELO, about playing ELO songs, because I actually like ELO. Do you have it's two questions really about ELO. Do you have any favorites among their songs, and are there any that are particularly difficult, that were difficult to learn? Because it seemed to me that their music was a little more complicated than the average pop song.
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to say that I was not a Styx fan myself. So when I got the call from Dennis DeYoung, I was like, you know, it was a practical job for me. But then I was ambitious, so I wrote a number of songs that, you know, that the band recorded. And I, you know, so I kind of did well with that move. Although, yeah, there are some, I like Tommy Shaw's material a lot, and they had their moments. But with ELO, I prefer ELO music to Styx music, for sure. I can tell you that Mr. Blue Skies, to me, is it's like as good as any Beatle record.
Mm-hmm.
That song, I have cried on stage when I see, you know, when an audience responds to that song, which I think is musically very compelling. And I'm happy to say I get to sing that song. So I'm in heaven singing a song that I admire that much. Yeah, and the audiences really do come alive for that stuff. So, I totally love doing that music.
All right, and I'm just going to say, for me, it would be Don't Bring Me Down. I just think that's a great song. I never get tired of that.
Yeah, that's our final song of the night. You know, that's our encore number, and yeah, people lose their minds over it.
Yeah, you know, and is it? You know, I remember when ELO was starting out, a lot of people dismissed them. Oh, they're just trying to copy the Beatles. They've got some complicated stuff going on there. And it's interesting to me that, you know, you really, your career kicked off playing Beatles songs and Beatlemania, and now you're playing in ELO. Which has some similarities, I think, to Beatles. Or is that overstated, or is that appropriate?
No, he absolutely, Jeff Lynne, is the writer and main guy in Electric Light Orchestra. He definitely is obvious. He's emulating the Beatles. So much so that when they put out the anthology records, the Beatles anthology records, Jeff Lynne produced the two new tracks that were, you know, like they, Yoko Ono gave a couple of cassettes to them, and they finished John's work tape. Yeah, so he ended up actually producing. So there's no, I don't think there's any question about what a Beatles fan he is.
Well, Lynn certainly got his due over the years with that, and then I'm thinking of his work with Tom Petty and the Traveling Wilburys. I mean, he was really recognized as somebody who had a unique sound and approach.
Talented guy.
Okay. Yeah. Well, listen, folks, you can see my former neighbor, and I've avoided talking about any of that. There's not really that much to talk about. It was all proximity. He was 5 years older than me. What can I say? But you can see my former neighbor, Glenn Burtnick, live in concert with the orchestra at Ruth Eckert Hall in Clearwater, Florida, on Friday, January 31st. You can get tickets online at RuthEckertHall.com. I saw from their website that there's a dinner package, a pre-show package. You know, you can get in for a little bit and just see the show. You can get in for a lot and have dinner. I don't think there's a meet and greet. They weren't advertising that, but you never know.
We're not a meet and greet band, but I do want to say that I have played Ruth Eckert Hall so many times with so many different acts.
Really,
I'm really blown away with it. When I saw that on the schedule. Like Ruth Eckert Hall, I played there with John Waite. I played there with Patti Smyth. I played there with Styx a number of times with Styx. I might have played there with Marshall Crenshaw, and now I'm playing there with the orchestra. It's just one of these stops that I guess one makes when going through Florida.
Well, it's a beautiful hall. I mean, you've been there enough, you know. It's a sensational hall. The acoustics are great. It looks great. That's great. And I'm just sorry to say that this is the first time I actually knew you were coming through in all these years. I didn't make the connection. Of course, you know, we didn't have Facebook through all those years, so it was hard to know, you know, what you were doing. But it's very cool. You've got your website. It's glennburtnick.com. It's Glenn with one N. I think you dropped the second end many years ago. And I know you're on Facebook. People can find you on Facebook. You're very involved with your friends and fans on there. Are you on Twitter as well?
Yeah, but I don't really update it often.
Okay. And I see that you've started a YouTube channel. You posted something, actually, from the Cats. You guys had a reunion just this past month. Is that right?
Yeah. The encore or something was a twist and shout, so I decided to not play guitar and just video everyone from my perspective. So I was the lead singer in the song, but while I'm singing, I've got a mic in one hand, I've got my iPhone in another, and it's like the Glenn Cam, I call it. Kind of a different perspective.
It's very cool. I tell people to look that up. I think you can just search Glenn Burtnick on YouTube. And it's the most recent clip as we're recording this. It's very cool because, yeah, Glenn is holding the camera, and he's showing the audience. He's showing the guys in the band. At one point, he turns it on himself just so you can see that it is him, and he's singing. And, you know, if you didn't see it was Glenn, you would wonder, because that version of Twist and Shout is rather Beatlesque, I would say. Was it how long had it been since you had played with the Cats, you guys had gotten together?
Well, that would have been, there was about 3 years ago, there was another reunion, and So, but before then, it was probably, 20 years.
So. You guys sounded good. You look good. So it's a fun video. I encourage people to pick that up. And there's plenty of other Glenn Burtnick video out there on YouTube. So you can look that up. Glenn, it was a pleasure to catch up with you. I'm sure this is probably the longest conversation we have ever had, because the only other one I recall is saying, no, you hold the guitar like this. No, your fingers go here, and I'd be just completely lost. I have no idea. My daughter, by the way, is an extraordinary guitar player, I just want to say. So it skipped a generation.
Wow. Well, I feel a slight bit like a failure. A virtuoso, but I'm really happy to hear that your daughter did.
Yeah, so you don't have to give my mom the $5 back, okay? Listen, my best to your family. It was great to see you today, and thanks really for joining us, Mr. Media.
Thank you. That was fun.